This podcast was recorded at Hartford Street Zen Center, Isanji, in San Francisco. Please help support our temple by making a donation at hscc.org.
I want to start by reading a poem by David White. And I don't want you to attach to the word so much, but more kind of the feeling of the poem. And this is called the House of Belonging from the Book of Poetry by the same name. I awoke this morning in the gold light, turning this way and that, thinking for a moment it was one day like any other. But the veil had gone from my darkened heart, and I thought it must have been the quiet candlelight that filled my room. It must have been the first easy rhythm with which I breathed myself to sleep. It must have been the prayer I said, speaking to the otherness of the night. And I thought, this is the good day you could meet your love. This is the black day someone close to you could die. This is the day you realize how easily the thread is broken between this world and the next. And I found myself sitting up in the quiet pathway of light, the tawny, close-grained cedar burning round me like fire, and all the angels of this housely heaven ascending through the first roof of light the sun has made. This is the bright home in which I live. This is where I ask my friends to come. This is where I want to love all the things it has taken me so long to learn to love. This is the temple of my adult aloneness, and I belong to that aloneness as I belong to my life. There is no house like the House of Belonging. So, with some good Dharma friends, I'm embarking on an undetermined amount of time will be dedicated to it, but maybe a year of studying the precepts and the 16 Bodhisattva vows. And some of the people that I'm studying with will be taking Jukai, and some we don't know. They don't know. But I wanted to kind of talk about that process, and particularly about the first piece of the 16 Bodhisattva vows, the taking refuge. So let me start. Is everyone familiar with the 16 Bodhisattva vows? Yeah? More or less? Okay, let me do a quick review. Always good to have an understanding of what I'm trying to talk about. In the process of Jukai, which through the Soto lineage is the process of kind of formally entering into becoming a disciple of Buddha, becoming a member of the Sangha formally, and as I said, entering into Buddha's lineage, we have this the ceremony called Jukai, and there are a number of elements to it. But at the crux of this ceremony, as is the crux of virtually all of the Soto ceremonies, is the taking of precepts and the 16 Bodhisattva precepts. The first three are taking refuge. I take refuge in Buddha, I take refuge in Dharma, I take refuge in Sangha. And the next three are what we call the three pure precepts. I vow to do no harm, I vow to practice good. And the way it's often said in this particular school is, I vow to live and be lived for the benefit of all beings. So in essence, the three pure precepts are about learning to restrain our unskillful behavior and embody skillful behavior and do no harm. And then the 10 precepts that follow are either called the grave precepts or the clear mind precepts. And those are more or less the things that are there that are helpful to us to remind us what we need to pay attention to if we're going to embody these vows. Not to kill, not to be to lie, not to steal, misuse sexuality, etc. Things like this. So that's kind of the paradigm of the, or the list, if you will, of the 16 Bodhisattva precepts. And the first part is kind of where we are in our group, but I think that it's kind of an interesting place to stop and to reflect upon. So Trungpa Rinpoche, And Mio was telling me a wonderful little tidbit about Trungpa Rinpoche and cigarette and suffering, but I'll let him fill you in at that over too. Trungpa Rinpoche, when talking about this process of taking refuge, says, "In the Buddhist tradition, the purpose of taking refuge is to awaken from confusion and associate oneself with wakefulness. Taking refuge is a matter of commitment and acceptance, and at the same time, of openness and freedom. By taking refuge, by taking the refuge vow, we commit ourselves to freedom." So in the, kind of to unpack this a little bit and take this apart, we have the word refuge, which is defined as a protection, a shelter. It can also be defined as solace. So this is what we're doing. We're actually taking refuge in these three jewels, right? Called the triple treasure, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And each and every one of them operates on multiple levels. So for instance, we have the Buddha, that is the historical figure, the actual man who jumped the castle walls, if you will, and wanted to learn how to transform suffering. We have Buddha, kind of the symbol or the metaphor that we can all awaken, that awakened enlightenment is possible. And then we have another level of Buddha, which is each and every one of us, and how we awaken in the context of all of the causes and conditions and circumstances of this very life, not the Buddha's life, not somebody else's life, this very life, right? And then Dharma operates similarly in terms of a big D for the teachings of Dharma, the impermanence, the no separate self, suffering. Dharma, for me, operates in another way in which it is the way in which I find these teachings in the context of my life. And then a third way in which I, as a result of going through this process of taking the precepts vow, to try and embody the Dharma and to be a vessel for skillful transmission of the Dharma in all the circumstances of my life. And then Sangha is, you know, on the one hand, a very vast, unfragmented spiritual ecology by which we all connect. Sentient beings, insentient beings, beings we like, beings we don't like, all beings, you know, are part of this, right? And then it comes down to the level of this Sangha, right? The community of spiritual friends who support us and help us practice. I was talking with Derek before the first, before we had Zazen, and just commenting on and reminded for myself how coming here when I was, you know, in my practice and starting my training more seriously a decade and a half or so ago was so helpful to really learning how to sit still, how to settle into myself. You know, this is one of the many things that this community, this Sangha of spiritual friends, helps us do. And then there is the Sangha of just everybody that I awaken with every single day. The people that are in my family, the people that are I choose to be close to, who have chosen to be close to me, the people in that proverbial Safeway checkout line, the people at the car intersections, the people on the sidewalks I'll meet as I go back up to my car after the morning program. So Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha are very dynamic and very multifaceted, right? And when we first come to practice, we think, oh, those are outside of me, right? Buddha is over there, and I need to do something in order to, a lot of things, very hard things, and for a long time, before Buddha could ever come close to me and to my life. Maybe you don't have different feelings. This is how I felt when I first started practice. Surely I can't be Buddha. That's not possible. Not this schmucky person that I am. My life can't be the embodiment of Dharma. It's just all such terrible suffering. And Sangha, my crazy family, and all of the people that I have such attitudes about, those, the people in my life, they can't be a Sangha. None of this can be a jewel. So this process of actually starting to take refuge, at a certain point in practice, people come to a place where, I'm sure many of you have already done this, where it's like, yeah, I want to seriously investigate. You know, at first it's kind of a bright light. Something's there that's attractive. What is this? Something has resonance for us. We don't really often know what it is, you know. We feel like we're just suffering so much, and God, I'll try anything. I'll even sit down and be still for a while. That's how desperate I am. Or maybe we see other people who are Buddhist practitioners and we think, oh, there's something there that I'd like. I'd like a little taste of that myself. That would feel good. Or maybe it's just the idea, you know, some of the ideas. But usually it's suffering that motivates us to come to practice. And there is some sort of a brightness to it. We may not know it. You know, one of the phrases I love so much is, this is from the transmission of the light, dark to the mind, bright to the heart. And I think that for me, that's what I felt about coming to practice. There was something that was bright that I couldn't articulate, something that was of interest, something that actually gave me a little bit of encouragement, but I didn't understand it. It was completely dark to my mind. So we come to Buddhist practice, and then we start to say, you know, I'd really like to understand this better. I'd really like to figure out what this attraction is. And at that point, we usually decide that we want to study more seriously, we want to affiliate ourselves with a community more deeply, we want to start working with a teacher to try and systematically or more have a guide in terms of our study. And then at another juncture, we might decide, oh yes, this is for me, and I really want to go more deeply into this process. And so that's where I am with several of my Dharma friends. And this aspect of taking refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha is at the very beginning. And so what does it mean? You know, what does it really mean? For it to be meaningful, it is, I think, for each and every one of us, a bit of a koan, right? One of these classic Buddhist riddles that are kind of designed to jam the wheels of our discursive thinking so that we can have a different experience and a different relationship. And so for me, this coming early in practice to what is it exactly that is refuge, and boy, oh boy, would I like some refuge. You know, it was really trying to figure out what all of these independent jewels meant, how I experienced them in my life, and whether or not I truly, truly believed that my life, this being, my community could actually truly be Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. So I think for many of us, we get hung up at this point. We just think, oh no, it's over there. Somebody else, somebody who has robes on, somebody else who seems better than we are. We just cannot, you know, initially take in that this is exactly where Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha not only live, but must live if practice is to be alive, if practice is to be vital, and if this is to be in any way of benefit to us and to the beings that we want to help. So, we you know, I know that you have heard this. We talk about Dogen Zenji in his Genjo Koan, Dogen Zenji being the founder of Soto Zen, in his Genjo Koan, the famous line about studying the self. That's where we actually start. To study the self is to forget the self, to forget the self is to be awakened and to, you know, let body and mind drop away. So this is the process that we actually go through in terms of practicing and initiating this aspect of taking refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha and making it our own. You know, just to put a little meat on the bones here and bring it down to a more grounded place, for myself, when I started this and working with my heart teacher, Darlene Koan, she was a Koan. Koan, you know, it was so helpful to have that relationship with her, where I had somebody who was able to be in relationship with somebody whose practice, as I understood it initially and got to understand it more deeply over the course of the years of our relationship, really reflected the embodiment of practice in a way that was attractive to me, in a way that benefited me, in a way that I wanted to emulate. And then I realized that I could really trust her. I could trust her as a mirror to reflect back to me, you know, exactly who she saw. And that is so helpful from the perspective of training. Because, you know, so often in the world, we're always looking into mirrors. We're looking into mirrors of friendships. We're looking into mirrors of relationships. We're looking into mirrors at work. You know, many of us are employed, and that's where we spend a lot of our time, and that's a whole huge area for practice. And we're looking into mirrors of family. Not all of these mirrors are clear. You know, the mirrors of my family, well, growing up in my family was kind of like growing up in one of the rooms of a fun house, where the mirrors are just all distorted, right? And you look into it and you see yourself one way in this person and one way in another person. So the benefit of having someone or a sangha that you can really trust that mirror that you're looking in, so that it reflects back a clear image. And not only with clarity, but with a kindness, because you know that you are joined together by a common vow. So you can trust, as I could trust Darlene, you could trust a teacher, you could trust Sangha, right? Because we all have the same intention. This is not always true at work, where we practice with people who don't practice, or in some of our relationships where people are still deep in their suffering. But to have the benefit of starting in on this practice and practicing with somebody who really is a clear mirror that we can trust is so, so helpful. So Darlene would say to me, you know, you put your competence before connection. And she would just say it over and over. And at first I didn't get it. I thought, well, what's wrong with that? Competence is good, isn't it? Isn't it great to be competent? Isn't it be wonderful? And not only am I competent, and yes, there's probably a way back here that I'm thinking to myself, I'm competent, and everybody can see this. But it's like there was another part where I sincerely thought, I'm competent and I can be so beneficial to the Sangha, because I can do a bunch of things that won't take a lot of people's time, and I can put this and that together really quickly, et cetera, et cetera. And over the course of time, I started to realize, oh, competence is a refuge for me. Competence is a place that I hang out so that I can be perceived a certain way, I can continue my self-notion a certain way, and at the, you know, as I continued this archaeological dig in a certain way on this personal koan, I realized, oh, it is a very, very convenient and comfortable mask for all the fear I feel about connecting. If I am competent, then I don't really have to connect with you. You don't have to really see me in terms of my suffering. Let me put on my competent face and go forward. And that was extremely, extremely helpful. So through this process of dealing with just, this is just one aspect, I can assure you that my teacher had much to work with, and brought it to my attention, which was helpful, I got to see, oh, this is part of the Buddha that Cynthia is. And can Cynthia be a Buddha with this, you know, inclination, this habit energy to move into competence? And can Cynthia work with this to expand this? And is it okay to sometimes just to be a competent Buddha? So these are just things that I learned about myself in this process of learning to take refuge in Buddha and Dharma and Sangha. In the context of Dharma, I just want to talk very briefly, because, you know, the teachings at first are for me were so attractive intellectually. I have to say that that's what first drew me into practice, was the sense of, wow, that's really cool, those teachings. And they really resonate for me. And coming from a dissatisfying relationship with the classic Judeo-Christian model, I really was very, very pleased with that, to find something that actually felt like it could, you know, engage me. But the, again, in this process of really learning to take refuge, you know, it was a very, very different process for me in terms of understanding impermanence in that big D Dharma sort of way, intellectually going, yeah, things are impermanent, that's true. And then to really experience the impermanence of the Dharma of my life when my younger sister died. And my best friend and my deepest sense of family and my deepest sense of Sangha suddenly was no more. And then I had to take refuge in impermanence in a way that was very, very different from the intellectual understanding. So for me, the understanding of all of these and working with them is in some way a journey of starting here, and this might just be my experience because I tend to be a heady person and spent many decades of my life living above my eyebrows. The journey is from how what refuge sounds like up here, what Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha sound like up here, and then the journey in which they travel here to the heart and the body, and they lodge there and they live there. That is very different. Living with the impermanence of someone you love who dies is very different than living off the pages of sutras and teachings that you can agree with about impermanence, right? So there's a way in which with all of these we have to make them our own. And that's the koan aspect of working with taking refuge. What is it about you and your particular being, all of the forces that have shaped you at this point in time, that that is Buddha, that has that potential to be Buddha? What are the hindrances to being Buddha? Can you really trust and believe that you are Buddha? Can ultimately we take refuge in this one as Buddha? Not in a way of elevating self over others, not in a way as separating, but just as a way in to really embody these teachings and to find solace in them and to find connection and vitality with them. A couple of quotes that I really like in this area are from Reb Anderson's book, Being Upright, a wonderful book on the precepts, if any of you are interested. He says, to take refuge in Buddha means to take refuge in who you truly are. And this is exactly another way of saying what is oft a phrase that's oft cast about. When you are you, Zen is Zen, you know? So we start out with this idea of who we are, my experience, an idea of who I am. I think I can't possibly be a Buddha. I actually have to go through the muck of all of the difficulties of my habit energy and the causes and conditions that got me to be this person that was so desperate in her suffering to actually try practice. I work with somebody very skillfully who works with me to actually start to have awareness of what my suffering is and who I am, to kind of come full circle to be exactly what I was when I started out. Cynthia went through this whole Dharma gate to come out being Cynthia, but with a different sense of who Cynthia is, right? And Joko Beck talks about it this way. She says, you know, it isn't that we have to reprogram ourselves. In a way, it's that we just are free of programs. You know, to actualize our Buddha nature, to feel the Dharma, to be aware of the Sangha in our lives, is about dropping off all of those ideas that I had, that surely you must be Buddha. Your life is Dharma. Your relationship with Sangha is genuine, but mine is not, right? So there's a way in which we come full circle when you are you, Zen is Zen. And it is just the same, and yet on the other hand, it is distinctively different because of the way in which we have opened up our hearts and our minds and our bodies and the way in which our understanding of who we are and what Buddha, Dharma, Sangha is has exploded and has really changed. So I honestly trust that my life and the Dharma of my life exists in my car when I'm driving, in my relationship with my mother when I'm listening to the story for the umpteenth time, I'm sure none of you have that experience. When I am on a conference call with a difficult work colleague, and my inclination is to just go, man, she is working my last nerve. If she were only out of my life, things would be so much better. And that's what I need to do. I need to, you know, just take a knife and surgically remove her, and then my life will be back to being not suffering. And then I'll be back to being a Buddha again, because I won't have to have this obstacle. You know, one of Dogen's great sayings that I take great heart in is, it is because we have obstacles. It is in the midst of these obstacles of our lives that we wake up and we realize our Buddha nature. That to me is very, very encouraging. But it is in those moments when I'm thinking, oh dear God, why does this person have to be so difficult and cause me so much suffering? And then I remember my practice. And then I remember the refuge that I've taken in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And I can say, this is a moment where this is one Buddha to another Buddha. And that reframes it entirely. It's not, you know, somebody inflicting pain and suffering on me. It's not Cynthia with her right idea of how things are. It's a much more spacious, level territory and terrain to occupy. Here we are, one Buddha to another. And here she is with her opinions and her habit energy and her behavior. And all I have to do is react to that. I don't have to make a judgment about it, right? And the experience becomes so much different. And I can actually sink into it and be present because of what I have learned about activating Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha in my life. And then the wonderful thing that happens when we train for a while is that these things start coming forward and activating us. Right? And so there's just a beautiful synchronicity there. At a certain point, when we live in intention and we live in vow, we fall back on these things. We have to, of course, actively engage them, but we fall back on them and they come forward to help us and support us. I mean, how many times have you been in situations where you might previously have said something very unskillful and you find yourself saying something actually surprisingly skillful, surprisingly neutral? This is our intention coming forward. This is the fact that we have already taken refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Taken refuge in the fact that we believe in our own Buddha nature, and we believe that everybody else embodies that Buddha nature as well. Dido Laurie, a wonderful teacher who died several years ago and established Mountain and Rivers Zen Center in New York, says, you know, we live, when talking about taking refuge, he says, it allows us to live completely and die completely. I like that very much as well. You know, prior to practice, and as many of you know, I'm also in recovery, but prior to these two important practices coming into my life and me coming into them, I always thought that there was always a way in which I was held back. You know, I was always waiting for that next bigger moment to arrive that I would enjoy or be able to be part of. But the mundane moments of my life never seem sufficient. And I like this stating of the taking refuge as a way that allows us to live wholeheartedly, to live completely, to die completely. Pema Chodron talks about this similarly, and she says, taking refuge allows us to let go of holding back. So all of those barriers that we had, all those ideas, again, studying the self, forgetting the self, drop away. And then Suzuki Roshi says, to be a human being is to be a Buddha. So we have countless wise people telling us that the taking of refuge of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha doesn't happen out here, but it happens in here. It is what we call, in another practice, an inside job, completely and totally. And yet there's, Neil, we're going to take questions down here. Should I take questions down here? Okay, then I'm going to bring this to a close, because I do want to have a little bit of time. So then what I think happens, you know, the process is a little bit similar to what Sharon Salzberg, who is from the Insight tradition, talks about in her book on faith. And I don't know if any of you have read this. It's a very wonderful book about her personal journey of being attracted to Buddhism and what happens. And she actually does talk about, you know, bright faith being where she starts. And then, as we're all encouraged to, and as what the process I've been trying to articulate, we verify it, we investigate it, we verify, is this possible? Is the Dharma in my life? Is the Sangha in my life? Is the Buddha in me? And then, assuming that we arrive at a conclusion that yes, indeed, and in fact, we are the just an extension of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, then we abide there. That then becomes the central, our spiritual zip code in a certain way. And we say that these principles, these 16 bodhisattva precepts, these vows, these become the organizing principles of our lives, and everything lines up around them. And what happens is that they then become, as I was, you know, mentioning a minute ago, something that we can really rely on, a shelter that we can take protection in, find the highest protection in, because we're learning to live skillfully out of our commitment to be and to take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. So I'm going to stop there so we have time for a few questions, and I thank you for your attention.
That is interesting that you said that there were things about Buddhism that were dark to the mind and bright to the heart, mm-hmm. but there were also a lot of things that were intellectually attractive to you that you had to embody in the end. So I'm wondering, like, what you think was the difference between those things, or can you articulate more, like, what was bright to your heart that you didn't understand at first?
You know, what's your name, by the way?
Shindo.
Thanks, that's a great question. You know, there's something about, I found my way through the doors of San Francisco Zen Center about a quarter of a century ago. And I have to tell you, I immediately felt a resonance there. Despite the fact that it was at that point in time a pretty grumpy place, you know, and very stern, and people were, you know, had a, I mean, there's been a very conscious effort to become much more friendly and outgoing and receiving over there, and it wasn't so a quarter of a century ago, and despite that, I really felt, wow, there is something here that really resonates for me, and I feel a connection with. And so that was one area in which I felt something that was very much bright to the heart, and I didn't yet understand it, and it was kind of coming back to that. Did you ask that question, or did you ask it the reverse way?
Or kind of either.
Either.
Whichever makes sense.
Yeah, and then I started to just listen to Dharma talks. You know, I was absolutely shameful in my preference. I'd go in at that point in time, nothing was listed online. I'd go and I'd look at the board and I'd see who was speaking and I'd go, nope, and turn around and go get coffee or go for a walk or something like that. I'd see Blanche Hartman and think, nope, too many words. And now, of course, I'd walk over hot coals to hear Blanche talk. So, you know. But I would listen to the Dharma and just listen and then start to read. And again, pieces of it I really wouldn't understand. Some of the concepts, you know, were very complicated. No self, what's that, you know? The body's a Buddha, what's that? But there was something beneath that that kept, you know, and I think that maybe that they don't happen in an asynchronistic way. I think maybe they happen in it simultaneously, and that was my experience. Yeah. Do you have a question?
Oh,
or a comment?
Well, when you were, thank you, first of all, for your talk. I heard the phrase, finding Dharma in your life, and sort of, and then you mentioned later on Dharma activating you, and mm-hmm. So I mean, I feel like that happens a lot. Like it feels like there's this interplay, like you talked about, between, you know, study of the Dharma and Dharma sort of coming, you know, at you sort of proverbially. That's not possibly probably the best way of putting it, but I liked how it seemed like the way you were talking about the refuges brought up for me the concept sort of the faith body,
mm-hmm.
and sort of really that sort of being capable of just really expressing who we are through that, and then taking refuge. So thank you.
You're very welcome. And I think at a certain point, you do operate on faith. You know, for many people like me, it's like, this cannot truly work for me. You know, this can't truly be my life. But you see it in other people. And then slowly, bit by bit, things start to turn. And if we are continued to be informed by our deep intention, which is very close to, but not exactly vow, but close enough to be very helpful, then I think with applied effort, we start to feel how it manifests in us. And that is a wonderful interplay. Yeah, thank you. Any other comments or questions? Yeah, Jennifer.
Thank you. Nice to see you.
Nice to see you too. Just a couple of comments. When you use the mirror metaphor, not metaphor, but the notion of the mirror and how the teacher, your teacher, Darlene, mirrored you, I went in a couple of directions there, and I know what you're saying, but I flashed on something Rev Anderson said during one of his koan classes in this Dharma talk, and he said, you're still looking to be mirrored, you're not ready to practice Buddhism. And I may not be, it's a paraphrase. And then another thing was...
I can assure you I was not looking to be mirrored. I'm sorry, please go on.
No, yeah. But that notion that you want the teacher to be reflecting the ego or some, parts that are kind of cozy and nice, and they're not doing that. It's like, if you're not ready for that, then you're not ready for Buddhism. Then that's sort of been a koan for me for a long time. And the other thing was... you said you look in these different mirrors, like family and worker, co-workers, or sangha, and I kept getting this notion of images flashing back at us, but other people who were just looking to be mirrored in an image doesn't really, there's a light in the mirror more than behind the images. So I may not be articulating this very well, but it's just sort of half done thought. So when you brought up that notion of maybe could you say a little bit more about your teacher being a mirror?
Yeah.
Or that would help me.
Yeah. I did not want mirrors. I mean, I only wanted mirrors that agreed with my self-concept, right? And so what Darlene did with me is she just was somebody I trusted wholeheartedly. She was very skillful. I knew she was kind, but could be very fierce. And so when she brought forward something, she offered me a mirror where I could see myself in a way that we can't see ourselves because we're usually always stepping in our blind spots. Okay? So I'm in a blind spot and I'm saying, competence, that's great. Wow, I get paid at work to be competent. Why would you not want for me to be competent? Right? Not seeing at all how it was a way in which it cut me off from other people. One of my great lessons on this, Jennifer, was I was at Tassajara on doing guest practice and guest work practice and on the cabin crew and, early in practice wanting to just get as many cabins done as well as I could get them done. And I came back to the woman who was the crew manager and I said, I need a new mop. And she said, wait for me, I'll go with you and we'll do it together. No, I don't need to wait. I mean, just give me the mop and I can get it done and we don't have much time. No, why don't you just wait for me? And she proceeded to go around and do some other things and I'm hanging out with my great impatience. And I said to her, I think a third time, I said, it's really not necessary. You're busy. You can do what you're doing. I'm trying to explain to her how she could be competent. There are times when Buddhist practice does look a little incompetent. But anyway, and finally, she was ready. And she said, she got the pail and the mop. And she said, now let's go. And we just walked together. Body-to-body practice, we just walked together, we went down to this cabin, we took off our shoes together, we entered the cabin, I did the mop, she held the pail. I mean, it was really inconsequential. But what I realized is that it was about connection, and that's what she was trying to tell me. I actually wondered if Darlene wasn't in cahoots with her on that one, because it was so what I needed to go. With competence, I'm just letting you be over here. I'm just going to my default position, which is, let me just go through life in a singular way, right? In a way that's safe. And she's saying to me, no, let's do this together. We're going to practice together. We can be, you know, have a sangha about this mop pail issue. And it was very, very brief, and it was very quiet, and it was positively transformative to me. I finally got what Darlene was saying about looking into Darlene, how Darlene saw me in the mirror, and how I allowed my competence to keep me very insular. Is that kind of a clear?
Yeah, because now I see it more as her body, mind, heart was mirroring, but it slowed you down. It slowed
yes.
down so that you could experience that sort of that competence.
Yeah. And what happens when I choose competence over connection? And she just faithfully kept reflecting that back to me. It took years for me to get that, really. It took years. And then I got it. Oh, okay. And it was actually her dying words to me as well. Remember, connection over competence. You tend to remember a koan if it's your teacher's dying words. So, yeah. So I think you're right. I think there's a whole other way of looking at the metaphor of mirror that we have to be very careful of when we actively look to somebody else to mirror us back. You know, please mirror back to me that I'm okay. Please mirror back to me that I'm a good person. Or let me project onto you that you're my father or you're my mother or you're my, you know, whatever it is. All that stuff that happens from a psychological perspective, transference and whatnot. And we have to be very, very careful of that. That's not exactly how I was using mirrors. But just where can we look to get a clear image? Whose vision, whose perspective of us can we trust to give us a clear perspective back on how we are? I mean, Darlene was never, she also clearly encouraged me that I had Buddha nature. She did that as much as to show me the obstacles to accessing that more often.
And so I see my problem before was it's not just ocular, visual. It's you're saying you can see and you can, and they're showing you. And when you explain it with the body stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a dynamic process that's part of that mirroring. Yeah. Thank you very much. I often use that image and no one has ever kind of helped me take it apart as much. I think I'll be more skillful of articulating it in the future. Thank you. Yeah. So. All right. I think that's probably sufficient. Thank you all very much.